And those who choose not to acknowledge these cold, hard facts, Mr. Sagari, are either unaware of the evidence, willfully blind, or lack a conscience. I'll give way to the Honourable Gentleman.
I'm very grateful to the Member for giving way, and I'm grateful for shining a spotlight on this important debate about excess deaths. But I'm just keen to understand the difference between correlation and causation, because there's a correlation between eating ice cream and sunburn, but we don't necessarily assume the two are together. Yeah. It could be sunny weather. The same goes for this case. Is it to do with the fact it's lockdown? Is it to do with late presentation, access to the NHS? These are the key bits to try and understand the causation and correlation, to understand why these numbers are so high.
I agree with the Honourable Gentleman. He is a medical doctor, so he does have some knowledge, clearly. But correlation is not causation. But correlation is an alarm bell, Sir Gary. And alarm bells are going off all over the building, but no one wants to open the door and see if there's a fire. I believe that future generations will ridicule us for what we've just done in response to a seasonal airborne virus. We apparently lost our collective minds. We've imposed a brand new type of quarantine on a healthy population, in breach of all previous public health advice, in breach of our own carefully crafted expert pandemic plan, in breach of flagrant breach of the sensible and experienced advice from many professionals. Those noble dissenters are being vindicated one by one, inevitably so, as the suppressed, shaming, real-world evidence finally emerges. I'm not going to mention those who harass and discredit and ridicule the dissenters. They loudly paraded their egotistical virtue on social media, in the press and on television. I know exactly what harassment feels like. And we inflicted social distancing, masking, and school closures on healthy children at no risk from the virus. We did this to protect adults at the expense of our children and their social and mental health. People raised alarm, Sir Gary, but nobody listened. A society that consciously and knowingly sacrifices perfectly healthy children for adults is sick in itself.
Welcome to the FLCCC Weekly Update. I'm Betsy Ashton, Creative Director of this Alliance of Medical Professionals and their supporters, you folks, that is. And you just witnessed Andrew Bridgen, a member of the British Parliament, debating in Parliament what many doctors, especially ours, see as alarming trends in excess deaths, as well as damage done to children following mandated lockdowns and the injections of experimental vaccines that were claimed to be safe and effective in fighting COVID. But emerging data is raising grave questions about those assertions. That debate was in January. But our Dr. Pierre Corey was in the UK at Andrew's invitation a few weeks ago. Needless to say, these two have become great allies in the fight for unbiased truth in medical messaging, medical research, and interventions. Pierre's going to tell you more about all of that, including the recent publication of a high-profile trial on the use of ivermectin for COVID. Hint. It's another one of those in which the headline and the conclusions are a bit different than the data that's in the trial. But before Pierre jumps on, know that we have two top nurses already on board. They are online to take the questions that you type into Q&A. And I will be back with many of those questions for Dr. Corey after he tells you what's going on. And we want to get started. So Pierre, come on in here. And I think the first thing that I need to say is, Andrew, we've got a time zone problem, right? It's where Andrew is, and he needed some rest.
Yeah, unfortunately, it sounds like his schedule got the better of him, and he's not going to be with us tonight. And I managed to wake him up in the middle of the night, but he just sounded exhausted, and I couldn't do it, so I gave him a pass.
Well, we're glad to have you here. You know, you certainly know the whole story. Tell us about that interesting trial.
Yeah. That's quite the story to tell. So. Let me share my slides. Where are we? Yeah, so this week, guys, I think probably a lot of our followers or listeners maybe have read my book, and I have a chapter in my book, which I call The Big Six, which goes over kind of the six largest trials that kind of founded the narrative that ivermectin is ineffective. And they're unique trials because they're the only ones that were heavily conflicted investigators with Big Pharma. Almost all of the other early treatment trials were not. And in that, at that time when I wrote the book, I said I could call the chapter The Big Seven because I knew what Oxford was doing. I knew what they were up to. It's just the problem was this is Oxford's principal trial. It was not published yet. And just last week, it was published. And let's talk about this trial because this literally sets a new record for brazen outright fraud that even I would say a seven-year-old could pick out. So this table is such a powerful table put together by the C19early.com group. And they show the design features of the trial, which obviously favor showing a medicine works versus showing one doesn't work. And, you know, what's so crazy about this is it's the same institution, the same principal investigator studying the same disease, two different drugs. And I'd like to ask the audience listening tonight, why do you think they insisted that anyone getting treated with molnupiravir get the treatment within 5 days from onset of symptoms? And why would they allow up to 14 days for ivermectin? I mean, who wants to know if a treatment is effective if you get treated day 13, right? And then obviously, the more mild patients you treat, the less able you're able to show an impact. Obviously, the sicker or older you are, more likelihood you're going to show efficacy. And also dosing and duration, right? So they kind of, if you think of a research trial as having like a bunch of knobs that you can control, and you can turn some up to show more sensitivity of finding efficacy, you could turn some down, you could see that the dials were totally turned down for ivermectin. And obviously there's no mystery as to why that is, right? I mean, you look at a drug that costs $707 for a treatment course versus one that costs literally less than a dollar, there's huge financial incentives to do this. And also ivermectin threatens markets across the world for the vaccines, molnupiravir, Paxlovid, all of it. Okay, so this is not new concept to you guys. But this was not all that they did. So if you look at some of those, you know, this is also a remote trial. You had to register. You were never seen by a doctor. You just sent these medicines. And there's, you know, a couple of participants who showed their actual consent forms that they were actually enrolled in the trial. They showed that up to 9 to 11 days after they first contacted the trial, they got their medicines. And so, you know, this is an absolute joke of a trial, but it gets even worse, right? They actually, at one point you could pick up the medicines from a local pharmacy, and they said, nah, we don't want to do that anymore. We want to send it to you. So you could no longer pick it up at a pharmacy. And then they also, in their information sheet, by the way, this is all detective work done by the C19 early guys, guys and gals. I don't know, they're anonymous, but they are absolutely masterful researchers. And they found on this information sheet that they literally removed the words next day. So they weren't even promising next day medicines to the patients in the ivermectin trial. And then they shut down the trial center for a few days a week, like in the middle of the trial. So, I mean, I kind of run out of words here, guys, you know, clown world, just brazen fraud. I don't know. But if this story isn't already bad enough, it really does approach just absurdity, criminality, clownishness. But this is just a list of what I call research crimes. And if you go to the C19early.com group's page on this, you can click on each one of these issues and they explain just how crazy all of these conduct flaws are and what their impacts are. Other weird things about the trial, there's a 19-month delay between when the trial ended and when it was published. You know, they literally went radio silent. And, you know, I wrote a Substack on this a couple of days ago, and my hypothesis for this was that, first of all, they had to figure out how to distort and bury this data. There's no question that it was a positive trial, because if it was negative, they would have immediately published that, and it would have led to another PR campaign against ivermectin, and, you know, nobody would have been surprised, right? But if you see, like, these are some of the other things that Oxford studied, and they're slow walking some of these studies to publication. Hydroxychloroquine, 3.7 years ago is when they finished enrolling. They did a two-month trial in early COVID. We still don't know the results of that. I think they're just going to bury that one. Ivermectin, you can see, had a really long delay. And then favipiravir is still not published. And we believe those two are both, actually all three that kind of had delays are almost certainly positive. Now, here's where it gets even crazier. So what speaks to me about how effective ivermectin is with all of those shenanigans they pulled, you would have thought for certain they're going to get a negative result, right? Well, they didn't. So now they got issues, right? So here you go. This is their co-primary outcome, which is time, self-reported time to full recovery. And if you look in the middle, you have a two-day shorter time to full recovery in those treated with ivermectin. And it was highly statistically significant. If you could see the probability of superiority, that's a Bayesian statistic, was greater than 0.999. So slam dunk, 2 days earlier, I think that would matter to almost anyone sick with COVID. Who doesn't want to get better 2 days earlier? I don't know anyone else who wouldn't. But the data gets even worse for them, right? When I say them, those who really are, whose jobs it is to distort and suppress the evidence of efficacy, you can see that although they didn't reach a positive result with death and hospitalization in the overall, in the concurrent group, they actually reported mortality differences with the non-concurrent group. So people who were treated earlier, like they had weird different control groups. Anyway, it had a massive reduction in mortality. But if you look at all the others, they're all statistically significant. Time to sustain recovery, early recovery, recovery at 3 months, 6 months, 12 months. Some of the symptoms ongoing at 12 months, all substantially and statistically significantly reduced in those who got ivermectin. And what's really surprising to me is that they were able to show impacts on the development of long COVID symptoms with 3 days of therapy given super late in the disease. I found that pretty shocking that they were still able to show, consistent, statistically significant results. This is buried in the 400-page appendix, but this is another forest plot. By the way, I didn't explain forest plots, but I guess you guys could just read, you know, where those estimates are shows which the data favors. You can see all of the improvements are centered over ivermectin. So we finally got a big positive trial, right, guys? And now there's, newspapers all over the world saying, the FLCCC and Pierre Corr and Paul Marek were right all along, and there's ticker tape parades being planned for us and stuff like that.
Right.
That didn't happen. So look what they did. It's truly unfathomable. So they published this in a little, I would call it a crap journal. It's the seventh ranked journal in just infectious disease. In that specialty, it's the seventh rank. Most of the other big six were published in the top medical journals in the world, not this piece of crap. So they slip it into this journal. And if you guys know, you've heard me say this before, most physicians, I think the problem with a lot of modern medicine and evidence-based medicines, most physicians are what I call ARPs, which are abstract reading physicians only. So they only read the abstract and they only look at the conclusion of the paper. They don't even look at the underlying data or how it's analyzed, how it's presented. And this is the biggest weapon of big pharma has to corrupt sciences, is they know that the conclusion of the abstract is all that really matters. And so this is how they wrote it up. Ivermectin, this is despite all the data that I showed you, right in their paper, amazing, consistent, statistically significant, somewhat modest magnitude, but they were so positive that it's unlikely to provide clinically meaningful improvement in recovery, hospital admissions, or longer-term outcomes. And then they add with a policy statement, which I've never seen in scientific manuscripts, but they actually recommend to the world that we shouldn't do any more trials on ivermectin. Because it's kind of like, this is the nail in the coffin, it doesn't work. So I know you guys are asking yourself, how can they write that it's unlikely to provide clinically meaningful improvement when right in their paper, they're saying it reduces time to recovery by 2 full days and it reduces a whole host of long-term symptoms. And it even has some signal, confusing as it might be, to preventing death. Okay, how did they do this? Well, they came up with a new statistic. I literally was like having to read this, like, what are they doing? They came up with this probability of meaningfulness and they set a couple of thresholds around it. They said for this, for ivermectin to be clinically meaningful, it would have to have what's called a hazard ratio of 2. So it would have to have like a huge magnitude benefit. Okay. So a hazard ratio of 2. Now, hazard ratios can be whatever they want. Anything greater than 1, in terms of a comparison of an outcome would show that it's an effective one. So if you look at budesonide, which is another trial they did, that one had a hazard ratio, if you see on that first row there, of 2.9, what was their hazard ratio? It was, that was the time to recovery. Their hazard ratio was 1.21. And with ivermectin, it was 1.15, statistically significant in both trials. And you'll see they both had high degrees of probability of superiority, but only ivermectin had this probability of meaningfulness. And of course, it couldn't reach it because they set the threshold so high. But literally, it's not only in no other trial that they've done, but it's not even in their trial protocol. So this is what it took them 19 months to do, was to invent a new statistic. There's other anomalies too, and I'll just kind of finish up here. I know because Andrew's not here, I went a little longer on this. I hope you guys are interested. But the other thing, that other anomaly, not only are they buried in the 7th ranked Journal of Infectious Disease, a journal I'd never heard of, but there's radio silence around its publication. I mean, I was Googling this weekend trying to find any mention of the principal trial in any sort of corporate controlled media, and there's nothing, complete radio silence. Even on their website, you can't find the trial. They are literally trying to hide this trial because it's a piece of you know what. And I just want to point out this, hold on, this idea of presenting a paper and its conclusions when it's not supported by the underlying data in the paper is not the first time this has happened. As some of our audience know, Paul and I met and became experts on the use of intravenous vitamin C in critical illness and sepsis. And there was a trial on ARDS, which is kind of end-stage lung failure, acute lung injury. And they had a massive mortality reduction with IV vitamin C. It was a secondary outcome. I don't want to go into that. But for critical care, I mean, it was, the mortality was 46% in placebo, 29.8% with vitamin C. That is a massive mortality reduction. It was statistically significant. And that paper was written up as a negative paper. They did not call any attention to the mortality. This is some data on the mortality, but this is just all the consistent positive things, the shortness of breath at all these time points. And so anyway, I'll just stop there by saying, this is the last big trial. And I don't know. I don't know how we get people to pay attention to this. I'm working on an op-ed. We're trying to get that published. I'm not sure it will be, but I think the world should be alerted to this crime. I mean, this is literally crimes. These are the crimes that have been committed around in research during COVID, which has caused millions of deaths around the world.
It's stunning. It's just stunning. We have a comment from somebody that you will find interesting, from N. Smith. And he says, in the patient participation notes, they listed the side effects of the drugs they might be given and the possible side effects for favipiravir appear under the ivermectin section and vice versa. Cut and pasted bits from the patient information sheets for the drugs. She says, I checked the drug leaflets as I was very surprised to see such side effects against ivermectin, as I had heard it was so safe. That's a new one.
I mean, that, nothing surprises me anymore. I think that's an interesting pickup. That's a person who wrote in. And just stack that in the list of stuff that I've already gone through. I mean, yes. Do you think that was an accident that they put the more worrisome and numerous side effects of a different drug under ivermectin? Whatever. So sad.
Incredible. Who pays these people to do this, huh?
Well, I think, yeah.
Who's the rewrite?
I mean, this is how you rise in, this is how you rise, this is how your careers progress. I mean, you toe the party line, you do the work that needs to be done, and that's how you get rewarded. Oh, that's another thing about this trial. Flavio Cattagiani picked up on this, but the editor of the journal that it was published in is actually the chair of the steering committee for COVE Boost trial, which is the huge trial where they tested 7 different pharmaceutical companies' mRNA vaccine boosters. Huge trial. I think it was like $2 million or $2 million grant. And this is the guy, the chair of the steering committee. So, I mean, the journals in deep with farm. I mean, it's the same story. It's a really tiring story, but people are dying. And so we got to keep talking about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Lots of people. Oh boy. Oh boy. Well, now the question is the excess deaths.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've written three op-eds about the excess deaths here in the United States. Ed Dowd, former managing director of BlackRock, he's put together and funded a team that's done extensive epidemiologic research, literally using government database data. I mean, he uses FRED for the disability data. He's using, CDC for mortality data. And, we have life insurance data. And I think many of our listeners probably know my work that I've done kind of following a little bit in Ed's footsteps. But the life insurance data, because I got involved with, Ed and colleague Josh Sterling, we tried to get life insurance executives to come together and make a public statement. I mean, we were hallucinating and that was going to be possible. And I think I've told the story before, but this is probably a year and a half ago, our first meeting. But when I got on that Zoom, it's probably 32 different people. Many of them were probably sent by the CEOs of different insurance companies. But all the cameras were off. All of the cameras were off. And several of us gave presentations on the data, what the data means, how we were convinced it was the vaccine and that people were dying. And out of all the people on that call, only two people spoke up. One was a life insurance, state life insurance regulator. And the other one was the chief actuary of a huge company who wasn't vaccinated. You could tell she was awake. But you could see there was no appetite to make a public statement. I think it's really important about this being life insurance because, if you look about the history of life insurance, granted, it's in their interest, but they have been huge pioneers in public safety. So maritime standards, zoning laws, electricity standards, automobile safety, aviation safety, automobiles, everything, and here, and also patient safety and medicine. They're really emotional book to read. You just see, all the newspaper reports that they've compiled of all these poor young children that are just dying, dropping dead in full health. And, it's a catastrophe. And, I'm proud of the work that the FLCCC has done in helping me, write op-eds. We've written three major op-eds on this issue. One in USA Today in August, November, we got into Newsweek. And then we got into The Hill back in a month or so now. And that generated a news cycle. I got on some television shows to talk about it. But, and then Ron Johnson had Ed Dowd on his panel the other day. But I think everyone listening knows, we're living in a really strange time in history. I mean, these are really unpleasant things that are happening about. And I think everybody in authority has every incentive to not deal with this, to keep it buried, leave it as water under the bridge, even as people keep dying and our CDC keeps telling people to get boosters. It's really shocking. So I don't know. I'm happy to do questions. I mean, I think maybe as folks in the chat, you guys could put the links to.
We've got plenty.
put the links to like my op-eds or I would watch Ed Dowd's presentation with Senator Johnson. All those presentations we did for Ron, they were sharp. They were potent, sharp, short. He wanted us to keep it, less than, I think we try to keep it under 10 minutes or 5 minutes. I think it was five plus minutes. And so Ed Dowd's is really powerful listening to him. So there's really good resources. And I think also a lot of our followers, they follow John Campbell. I mean, that's why we had Andrew, because Andrew's literally the only guy in the British government who's literally sitting there standing up. He gets so much hatred and attacks. Now, he also gets a little bit of love, but it's private love, meaning there are other MPs who will come up to him and say, "Keep going, Andrew, we're with you."
As they sit like there, a lot of doctors do that to you, right?
Oh yeah, same thing. But it's it's shocking when you see politicians with such cravenness. But and Andrew's such a powerful speaker, so just witty and brilliant, and he's also just an all-around great guy. I've had the honor, literally the honor of going out with him socially several times, and just wonderful evenings. I have so much respect for the man, and he sends his apologies. He just messed up, and I let him sleep. I know how hard he works. I just didn't want to pull him out of bed. So anyway, hopefully I'm doing a decent job in substitution.
Well, hopefully we can get him back when maybe he's around here, or maybe we're in the same time zone or closer. Wouldn't that be nice?
I mean, yeah, we'll get him back.
Because he's certainly doing the job there. He's speaking out. Well, are you ready for questions? Because we've got them.
Yeah, sure. Whatever. If I don't know the answer, I'll say I don't know. Or I'll look for Paul, but Paul's not here.
Here's one. Do you believe the Florida model of dealing with COVID was the correct model to use? One of our viewers wants to know.
Wait, which model?
Florida. What they did in the state of Florida.
Oh, yeah. I think they could have even been more aggressive, in terms of being conservative. You know, I think they did lock down for a brief time, but they were pretty early to get rid of the mask nonsense. Lockdowns, I think they were against. I haven't followed too much, but what I would say just in general about Florida is the reason why Florida is such an outlier in this country is because you literally have a Surgeon General who has independently and publicly analyzed the data supporting these policies, whereas there's no evidence that any other health minister, or Department of Health head has done this or come up with a contrarian opinion or provided any data to support them doing anything different. They just take the orders from the feds and, you know, everything's in lockstep to keep the money flowing. And I'm really impressed with Joe, and really I have to say Governor DeSantis, because I can't imagine that what they're doing doesn't come with penalties in terms of fun. I mean, the feds have a lot of control and they have a lot of money. And so I think it's remarkable that they're doing that. But yeah, I can't think of anyone better than Florida, really.
Now, here's a question that gets into, of course, the work that Dr. Marek has been doing, but he's on his way out to an important conference. So he's not with us tonight, but a viewer says, I have prostate cancer and am following Dr. Marek's protocol. Why does he recommend doxycycline? This damages your gut biome, correct?
Yeah. It's because there's data for it. There's data for it in cancer. I when you say destroy the gut biome, of course it has impacts on the gut biome. How negative and how clinically meaningful it is, I'm sorry to use the word clinically meaningful, depends in terms of risk benefits. And I think from someone suffering from a potentially terminal cancer who wanted to use every possible mechanistic therapy, there would be a role for it. Now, I believe in Paul's document, we're not recommending long-term. I think it's for a month and to use probiotics to try to mitigate those impacts. But I think it's a totally fair question. I've been starting to treat cancer with repurposed protocols, and I haven't really, I'll be honest to that questioner, I've left doxy off a couple of times. I think I have the same concerns.
All right. Suzanne asks, does baobab have to be taken away from antibiotics by a couple of hours like a probiotic?
I don't know. That would be a question for Scott. He's the baobab expert. So I don't know that, but certainly I've never heard Scott make any of those recommendations. And we kind of have these, in our notes and our communications with our patients, we have a lot of pre-written kind of informational chart parts, they're called. And, you know, we do a little summary of baobab, how it works and da-da-da and concerns around it. But we don't say anything about having to worry about the spacing out when you take it. In fact, you know, the way that Scott has recommended is that you kind of sip it throughout the day. So you get little short doses throughout the day.
Okay. Here's another one. Mary says, asks, some time ago, there was a discussion on one of the weekly calls about the use of stevia. Yes, there was. There was a difference of opinion about the safety of its use. Dr. Marek said you would all research and let us know. Was a decision reached on stevia?
I missed that one. Sorry.
I know. That was Paul again. All right. We'll have to check back when Paul is back on. We can do that one. All right. Natalie asks, there seems to be a growing campaign in the media regarding the danger of too much vitamin D. I know mostly everyone is deficient in vitamin D. So how often and how much? I've been taking vitamin D 5,000 units daily for the past couple of years. I'm now taking vitamin D 5,000 plus vitamin K. Please advise.
Yeah. So I'm not aware of those stories, but I'm not surprised. If I don't want to always talk about my book, but you know, the genesis, the inspiration for my book is when I learned about disinformation, and I learned about disinformation campaign by a vitamin D researcher. I mean, vitamin D, I think, has the biggest threat to the profit potentials of big pharma. I think they know this. If we all had, and I don't even want to say that if we had normal vitamin D levels, because that's also corrupted. The reference range of normal in this country is not what we should be shooting for. We should be shooting for higher. That's number one statement. Number two, we have data showing that no one really dies from COVID if your vitamin D level is above 50. For cancer, Angus Dalgleish talked about this. He noted that all of his patients who do better, they have higher vitamin D levels, and those who do worse have lower vitamin D levels. So he's always been treating with vitamin D. Then the third thing, especially in terms of this question, where there's, if there is some absurdity that someone's looking in a major media outlet that there's harms to vitamin D, that's pretty much nonsense. So let's talk about that, because I myself, and I know colleagues, and Flavio does, there's a guy named Coimbra down in South America who uses high-dose vitamin D protocols to treat autoimmune diseases. He treats MS. He apparently gets amazing results with multiple sclerosis. And there, we can use doses 30 to 50,000 a day. Now, there are rare cases of vitamin D toxicity. And what that means, it just means you'll get hypercalcemic. So your calcium in the blood can go high, and that can cause confusion, lethargy, different things. But it's quite rare to happen, number one. Number two, when you put someone on high doses of vitamin D, and by the way, I'm doing that with the cancer patients. They're going on, I'm starting them at 30. And what I do is I just check what's called a parathyroid hormone level, because vitamin D suppresses your parathyroid hormones, and that's why your calcium rises. So I just check monthly calcium and parathyroid hormone levels. And if your parathyroid hormone drops below the normal range, or your calcium goes too high, that's when you stop and you can titrate the dose. So you can do much higher doses. I personally take 10,000 a day, and I just got my vitamin D level checked this week, and it was 70. And I'm sitting pretty on a 70, so I'm doing okay.
And you look like a picture of health. You're really looking there. You're lean and mean. You're ready. All right. Here's something that Annette saw, and I saw this too on the internet. Just saw a new article that a man in Germany had 217 COVID booster shots. Why? I don't. And is doing great. That was the point.
So is this the exception that proves the rule or something? I don't know. It must be a safe shot.
I wouldn't do that.
It's statistically improbable. I mean, first of all, I don't even know what that is. No one's getting 200. What was it? I'm going to pass.
Okay. Now, Dave asks, do you think we might increase public awareness of vax injury by having the injured file complaints against complicit physicians with their state licensing board for violation of the standard of care for safe medical practice in regards to basic interpretation of the literature, assessing safety and efficacy of the Pfizer 2-month data, communicating risks and benefits, respecting for patient autonomy, and allowing for informed consent?
I love the articulation of the question and what they wrote and how they articulated what these doctors are violating. And I think there's total grounds from a complaint. However, they're not going to do that. I mean, the boards are not going
to touch it.
They're not going to intervene adversely with a physician who was part of the vaccination campaign. I mean, they're doing the opposite. They're going after doctors who said negative things about the vaccines. I mean, just today, I think some of the listeners know, but I've committed to doing pro bono defenses of any doctor who's getting persecuted by their medical board. And I just did a 2-hour meeting this afternoon with a team of lawyers getting ready for a defense of Dr. Michael Turner in the state of Washington. And then I was contacted yesterday by another doctor. And all of these doctors, they're getting persecuted for using repurposed drugs and or not telling their patients to get vaccinated. And that's actually the biggest one that we're going to have to defend him on, is that the board is going after Michael because he didn't document that he recommended the vaccine to his patients.
Yeah. top-down medicine, if ever.
Yep.
Putting a gun to your head, basically. You know, you lose your license. You do what we say or you lose your license. Great.
So sad. The whole
thing is so sad. In America, huh?
Yep.
Anne asks, should melanoma patients on immunotherapy avoid AC glutathione or vitamin C?
AC.
I'm sorry. There's an N there. It's NAC. The N was in lowercase. I thought it was an error. Let me read this again. Should melanoma patients on immunotherapy avoid NAC / glutathione or vitamin C?
I don't know the answer to that because I don't know of any the interactions or relationships between the immune therapies and those supplements. I have a vague recollection of glutathione having a little caution or concern around glutathione in cancer, but not directly in yeah, maybe the best way is just to say I don't know.
All right. Joyce asks, does ivermectin, you definitely know ivermectin, does ivermectin stop heart palpitations? Mine were PVCs, not atrial fib. Mine started in February 2023 when I had COVID for the second time. Been to a cardiologist, started on verapamil 120 ER, but it only attenuated the PVSs. I was off and on ivermectin, and each time it seemed to stop the PVCs. Finally, I got it through my head. It was the ivermectin treating it. I've been using it solid now for 15 days, and while on ivermectin, no longer feel any PVCs or find them taking my pulse. Is this possible with PVCs? Thank you so much. Double exclamation point.
Well, you know what? I'm going to have to be honest and say I can't recall a clinical instance where someone reported that benefit. But I'm going to put it onto the list of benefits that have been reported to me in relation to ivermectin. I mean, you know, one of the things I tell my patients in my practice when I treat them for vaccine injury or long COVID is that disease is so mystifying to me. But when I start someone on a medicine, like for instance, ivermectin, we think about 70% of our patients have positive responses to ivermectin. I can't even tell them what it's going to help. I mean, in some patients, they report that their energy levels greatly increased. Others, it's brain fog. But some will say it didn't do anything for my energy or it didn't do anything for my brain fog, or it helped with their joint pains, or it helped with this. And so it's just like, I just see these varied clinical responses. And I think that's pretty cool about the palpitations. I will say one of my most recent kind of satisfactions was I have a patient who's a radiologist who got he had a distant history of childhood asthma, very mild asthma in his life, got the vaccine, and then developed moderate persistent asthma, daily symptoms. And he got under control with the typical asthma meds, like an inhaled corticosteroid. But I told him that there's good animal evidence for asthma, for ivermectin with asthma. And he was totally willing to try it. Put him on ivermectin. The next time I saw him, he was down on his dose of inhaled corticosteroid and he hadn't had to use his rescue inhaler in weeks. And I have another patient who I'm also trying that on too. So I don't know, put it on the list of stuff that it can help.
Oh, lovely. How lovely. All right. Here's a question from Katsuhiko Fukuda, an MD, PhD, who writes, in Japan, the total number of excess deaths in the 3 years after COVID-19 vaccination was found to have increased by a whopping 450,000 compared to the previous year before vaccination. This is twice the more number of deaths caused by the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Whoa. In addition, Japan's post-vaccination birth rate is the lowest ever recorded in pre-war data, and the stillbirth rate is beginning to rise. These phenomena are at a rate of 2 deaths per 1 birth. And if this trend continues, Japan is in danger of disappearing. So what kind of fact-finding should be done to establish a causal relationship between vaccination deaths and the explosion of excess deaths?
I mean, if you could see from the opening video of this webinar, You know, the rebuttal to Andrew's statement by whatever, whoever that person was in the parliament, you know, like I said, there's every incentive for everyone in authority to not blame the vaccines. I mean, that person is describing data in Japan, which is, again, humanitarian catastrophe. I mean, it's I don't know if you want to use the word genocide or whatever, but it's shocking how many people are dying. And yet our normal daily life seems to just go on. And I think there's good portions of society that are aware that these are the vaccines. But I don't know that how you get this to attention. I mean, the question that the person asked was like, how can you prove that's the vaccine? That's how I'll paraphrase it. And I'm going to say from the beginning, you would really just need to do proper autopsies, which is you do an autopsy and you stain for the spike protein. You get samples of the tissue from various organs, and then you apply what's called an immunohistochemical stain, which identifies whether there's spike in tissues and or if it's associated with any tissue damage. And that's work that a few pathologists in the world have done, right? So Arnie Burkhardt in Germany, Ryan Cole's done a little bit of work, Suturi Bhakti in Germany, and they've been persecuted. And but you have the standard of care is they're not looking for spike. And I think I told this anecdote. I believe I told this anecdote on the webinar, but I'll tell it again because it still shocks me. But over Thanksgiving, I was out at a social dinner and I was sitting with a pathologist. And I was just like, he's a system pathologist. And I was just talking to him and I said, I just looked at him and I said, hey, man, are you guys staining for the spike protein? And his answer was, what's the spike protein? Is that something to do with vaccination? So this is a pathologist at, you know, in November of 2023, who doesn't even know what the spike protein is. He's a pathologist. We're talking about one of the most toxic and lethal pathogens in history, which is the spike protein. And that's where we are, guys. I don't know how to get out of this.
How can that be? Really?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. All right. We got some more good ones here. Joaquin says, I started a patient on ivermectin today for glioblastoma. He is 86 years old, does not want standard treatment. I have started on 0.4 milligrams per kilogram. Studies show 20 milligrams per kilogram. Any input? What would you recommend?
I wouldn't use ivermectin for glio. Ivermectin doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier. If you have a damage or a defect in your blood-brain barrier, ivermectin has the potential to cause toxicity. So I personally wouldn't use it. I would use any of the other, I would use combinations of any of the other medicines. You know, the vitamin D, mebendazole, or even Fenben if you can't get mebendazole. But I think there's a lot of other options that I would use in combination.
From the protocol that we have there. Very good information. Jillian asks, I'm 45 and released from the hospital after having a stroke just a few weeks ago. MRI appeared to be clear, and at my age, they have no idea what could have caused this, therefore. It was blamed on clotting from sitting at a desk all day. My question is, after being vaccinated and having this stroke, is it likely to occur again if I've been diagnosed with post-vac syndrome from another health professional?
So I don't know how to answer likely that it can happen again, but I have definitely taken care of patients with multiple strokes. And they generally don't show up because this is microclotting. Remember, that's a new word in medicine. I never used the word microclotting before COVID and really before the vaccines. You know, in my practice, we do microclotting tests. We put people in different protocols of things that degrade spike, that thin the blood. You know, we sometimes use half dose Eliquis. I mean, I wouldn't say we make it up, but we don't have really good evidence to suggest this. But I would tell you, a stroke is scary. It's one of the most, you know, dangerous things that can happen in terms of these vaccines. And so I would be on a spike reduction protocol. I would check the spike antibody level. And I would use some amount of aspirin, maybe half dose Plavix, natokinase. You know, I'd have to think of the patient, how sick they are, how young they are, and how aggressive I want to be. I would look at their microclot test and come up with an informed judgment of doing something to prevent this from happening again, because it can. I know it's happened to people multiple times.
Bob asks, my son and his wife are planning to have children. Both got the first two shots back in the spring of 2021. They have no vax-related problems. With that said, would you recommend any detox supplements, drugs?
Yeah, so I'm going to say that if you ask that question to a few different doctors, it's almost like any question you ask, you're going to get a few different answers. I will tell you, Scott and I, we vary a little bit in how we practice. And I think because we have different senses of risk tolerance. And for me, in a completely asymptomatic person, I generally leave them alone. But patients are also varying their risk tolerance. Some are very concerned, so that they're concerned about their own history of vaccine, and they'll come and I want to get some of these tests, get a spike antibody level. And if I see somebody asymptomatic who wants me to potentially help anything bad from happening, then I'll do a few tests and I'll make some suggestions of things they could take if they want to. I like natokinase. I take it myself as just a natural supplement, just because, it's associated with not only longevity, but decreased rates of atherosclerosis and heart attacks. And so, and it degrades spike protein. So, I mean, that's some like simple stuff you could do. But in general, I'm not looking for trouble in someone totally asymptomatic. And then the other thing is, some of these vaccines were not harmful. I mean, they were, the manufacturing process was so bad. I think some of them were inert, benign. Others were immensely toxic. And I don't know, it's been 3 years since their vaccines. And if they're doing well now, I think I would leave it alone.
Matt Helmer wants to know, says, we spend a lot of money on science while getting little in return. I believe the experience of the last 4 years, shows us that science can be leaner, more agile, and more effective. How do we establish independent science?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, right? I mean, I have a rich network of colleagues now through my work in COVID. We are talking about trying to create more journals that are completely free of pharmaceutical influence. We already do have one, the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons, in their original charter. They do not take pharma money, and that, I believe that they're free of financial conflicts of interest. Hector Carvalho, our friend, he and one of his partners, they have a journal down in Brazil. We're now in discussions of maybe creating an FLCCC journal with Joe Verone. But I think you really we have to do something about conflicts of interest. And, another thing that I think is at the agency level, and this would only be possible if someone like a Bobby Kennedy got elected, but, we'd have to change how those agencies are run and led. And you'd really want to institute like a governing committee of those agencies with a broad stakeholders. From not only public and private people, but with zero conflicts of interest. Put some priests in there, put some philosophers, put some nurses. You want a broad representation of people, and but it's really all about conflicts of interest. And unless we can figure out how to create a space where people not only can be but have to be objective, I don't know. I think it's really hard. I mean, the system's really rotten and captured.
Well, all of these regulatory agencies were originally set up to take away the power of the manufacturers who basically did what they wanted. And so somebody was supposed to be working in the public interest is the basic, phrase to see that the public was represented and that things were safe and effective. And yet, if the people on those panels are basically getting their money from somebody who's in the manufacturing business or somebody who's been set up by the manufacturers to funnel the money over, you've lost the whole point. And that's what we've got, right?
Yeah. No, and I think there's so many weapons that pharma controls, our government and our agencies, but someone just put it in the chat. I mean, the revolving door is probably the biggest one. I mean, you play nice for pharma when you're sitting in your government job, you're going to do just fine when you leave. And, you know, and then people go out, they make money, and then they get put back in. You know, I mean, did you ever see the revolving door, the head of the FDA? I don't know how to clean up. I don't know how to interrupt that revolving door, but these are real problems. But, and I get these questions, right? I think I think everybody wants to know where to look, where can we go? And we can't trust the advice and guidance of literally these hugely funded billion-dollar budget agencies. And I wouldn't say that the FLCCC is a replacement for all of those agencies do, but you know, we're doing as best we can. You know, Little Bad News Bears, FLCCC, we're trying to put out, you know, as objective a reading of evidence that we think we're capable of. And we put out general good guidance on how to approach a bunch of diseases and avoiding pharma frauds. We're surrounded by so much pharma frauds, from, you know, statins to SSRIs to Tamiflu to these vaccines. I mean, it's just endless.
Here's a couple more good questions here. Oh, here's from another Betsy. How do you answer folks entrenched in the dominant narrative who discount that excess deaths are attributable to the vaccine and instead chose to view them as the result of deferred medical care during the lockdowns?
The sad answer to that question is I don't. I don't know why, guys, but I'm just going to admit it. I live in a bubble. Everyone in my life, anyone who talks to me, interviews me, that I meet at a conference or wherever I lecture, everybody is awake. Everybody I know is awake to this. So I don't find myself ever in a situation where I'm talking to someone who's literally trying to convince me that the vaccines are, you know, the greatest thing since sliced bread. Everyone I know knows this. And so I don't.
Not here.
Not in that situation.
Not around where I live. You know.
Yeah. Well, I don't live in your neighborhood, Betsy. I don't think
I know. Well, this is pharma country. I mean, the New Jersey, they're all, half of them are headquartered here. At least they're operating here. So yep. I have a neighbor, and I will tell you this. I think it's very interesting, who was an executive in PR for one of the major pharma companies. He's now elderly. He's, you know, and health has health concerns that are very serious. But he told me what his job was. And his job was solely to go out whenever they had a new drug coming out and to court the physicians in that specialty and to get them on board, to pay them so that they would make great announcements about that drug, basically sell it, physician salesman. So they go on television. And that was it.
I got to tell you, I hope this is not egotistical, but I just want to tell you what it was like for me. So when I finished medical school and I went into residency, I was an intern and I was up in West Harlem in New York City. And all of my fellow residents, they'd be like, hey, and I was a little older because I went to medicine older. So I was presumably a little bit more mature, but they were like, hey, we're going out to dinner. You know, this drug rep is taking us out. You know, we can drink as much as we want and the food is delicious. And like, I didn't want to go. I had a wife, I had young kids, and I wasn't really interested. But I did go to one lunch during the day. I went to one lunch for an antibiotic rep, a ceftriaxone. And I got to tell you, I just remember feeling really uncomfortable. I just felt it was wrong. I didn't like being at that lunch. And I have never gone to any other drug dinner or event, and nor have I ever given a talk for a drug company. And I've been asked, but
that's why we trust you and we love you.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it was just
more doctors like you.
I think there are other doctors. There's certainly a lot of doctors, but probably not enough of them.
Have time for a couple more? We've got some more.
Okay.
All right. Here, Sadie S. said, several friends took monoclonal antibody infusions while they were being offered to treat their COVID. Some of them are having problems now. Were blood products used in them?
In the monoclonal antibodies?
That's the question.
Blood products, as in not from blood. I think those were all synthetic. I don't believe that there was any blood product in a monoclonal antibody. As far as I know, I'm not an expert on those, and I've never used them.
Liz asks, do you know of any cognitive issues with Paxlovid? My 91-year-old mother has had severe issues, including confusion, delusions, and incredible memory problems both times she has taken it. It is not listed in the package insert, but someone said Paxlovid is a combination of two other medications, and one of them does cause cognitive issues. Mom did get somewhat more clear thinking after the first time, and I'm hoping this time as well. I had her on IVM, but siblings vetoed it.
Yeah, I've seen that situation before. I really don't know, because I've never used Paxlovid. One thought I have is that it has 125 different drug interactions across 25 different classes of medications. So it could have been a drug interaction, could be the drug itself. It could have been COVID. I mean, COVID in a 91-year-old, we do see confusion and sometimes delirium. But yeah, unfortunately, I'm not deeply studied on Paxlovid. And I'll just tell you the simple reason why. I laugh. I just laugh at that drug. I mean, I would never ever use it. But unfortunately, it's what's approved in this country. And, you know, most people drank the Kool-Aid and still trust these institutions that, you know, the NIH says Paxlovid is standard of care for the outpatient and, you know, for high-risk outpatients. And people believe that.
D asks, have you heard of vision issues with taking ivermectin? Three
Sure.
in my family have had issues. It subsided after stopping the medication.
Yeah, it's one of the more common side effects. And so that is not uncommon.
Vision issues.
Yeah, some people say 10% of people have them, but it's generally mild. And as that person said, it's absolutely classic. It's totally transient and it stops when you stop the drug. And so if someone was really sick and that's all they had and they were having vision disturbances, I would tell them just to keep using it. It's not permanent, you know, it's not going to harm you. But it is concerning, right? No, you know, our eyes and our eyesight are so essential to how we feel. You should know, Betsy.
Yeah, I've been there, done that.
So I get it. I mean, luckily we have other choices on our protocols, and I hope most of our listeners are loaded for bear at home. They have a number of different elements on our protocols. I mean, I personally at home, I have a good supply of hydroxy, ivermectin, nitazoxanide, all the sprays, all the other supplements. So, you know, I would just say, if you can't use ivermectin if you don't like the vision thing. Just, you know, double up and use as many combinations of the other stuff as you can.
Good to know. And this, I've been advised, this might be a good one to end on. Wait till you hear this one. You're going to like it. Nina asks, would you consider taking the Surgeon General position in the new administration to keep truthfulness in national health issues?
You know, the Surgeon General would be a good fit for me because I remember Del Bigtree asked me that in terms of like the FDA. I think he was just messing with me. But when I was in an interview with Del, and Del's like, so, Pierre, if anyone ever asked you to be the head of the FDA, would you do it? And I mean, my first reaction is an absolute laughter because I couldn't picture me walking into the FDA building every day or being the head of the FDA. I mean, I can barely manage the FLCCC or help manage the FLCCC, but that wouldn't not be a job I would want to do. But Surgeon General is more of a good fit. He's kind of like a spokesperson. So like I could just go out and tell people good stuff. I'd give them good guidance and tell them, you know, give them good advice. So yeah, I like that job. I'll do the Surgeon General one. Right? That's
there
like a
know.
Spokesperson.
Wonderful.
You don't have to manage anybody, you know?
Well, remember when we had a wonderful Surgeon General who actually came out and told the truth about cigarettes?
Yep. Yep.
And that was big news. That's back when I was in the news business. So I remember that very well.
And you know, it's interesting because I'm watching the chat here. Like when I was a kid, I mean, the Surgeon General was like a big deal. Like everybody knew who the Surgeon General was. I mean, prior to COVID, the last 10 years prior, I don't think anyone knew who the Surgeon General was. Even now in COVID, I don't know the guy's name. But yeah, when I was a kid, Surgeon General was like a big deal. I remember C. Everett Koop, right? He was cool.
Yeah.
I liked him. Yeah.
All right. Well, Pierre, thank you. Thank you for carrying on and taking the, you know, doing all the good work and taking all the good questions. And we thank you so much. We'll have to get Andrew Bridgen on one of these days when we can find a time that it's not in the middle of the night where he is. And we certainly want you back every time we can get you.
And Betsy, someone just said that I get to wear like a uniform and look like an admiral. That'd be kind of cool.
Then I'd have to paint your portrait. You never know, you know? Yeah, well, we might do that anyway, but okay. You have a great week. And I've got a few announcements. Folks, there's a lot of good stuff going on that I want to tell you about. So hold on one second. We just say goodbye to Pierre. And let's get to, all kinds of stuff. You know, we have quite a few upcoming events that you want to know about. The first one is coming right up this very weekend in Las Vegas, where our own Dr. Paul Marek is traveling to speak at the COVID litigation conference, along with legal and other medical experts. So stay tuned for updates on that one. Now then, our next X or Twitter space is next week. It will feature Dr. Michael Turner, who you heard about earlier, and our two great Christinas, Dr. Christina Carmen and Christina Morrows, our CRNA, who you'll see in a minute, for a discussion on long vax, long COVID, and immunity. Make sure to have your questions ready and mark your calendars for Tuesday, March 12th from 8 to 9:30 p.m. That's Eastern time. You can set a reminder for the space at the link that you see on the screen. All right. There is a rally to reclaim free speech. And, you know, so you can't put your calendars away until you mark this one, because it's a few days later on March 18th, the Children's Health Defense will be hosting the Rally to Reclaim Free Speech in Washington at the Supreme Court building. Our own Drs. Marek and Corey will be speaking there, as well as Del Bigtree from the High Wire, Mary Holland, president of the CHD, and other leading voices from the movement. The event begins at 9 a.m., and if you are able to make it in person, please do, because the more voices out there, the better. You can find more information on the link on your screen, and please make sure to share this with your freedom-loving friends in the area. Get them to go, too. Now then, as we mentioned last week, all lectures from last month's Healthcare Revolution Conference in Phoenix are available to view now as part of our Education on Demand platform. The package includes dozens of sessions, including panel discussions, lectures, case reviews, and the Q&A, plus downloadable PDFs of all the speakers' presentations. It is available free of charge, although we do ask for a donation if you're able to help cover the costs of producing this incredible and life-saving information. You can learn more or watch the lectures now at flccc.net/EOD. Forums. Speaking of healthcare revolution and of free speech, for that matter, you have joined our, have you? That's the question. Have you joined our new FLCCC forums yet? Have you? It is an incredible place to connect with the like-minded people, to share information, to learn, and perhaps more importantly, to enjoy a censorship-free space in which to do all of this. So if you haven't signed up yet, please head over to flccc.net/forums and register now. We have a new guide. We have a new wellness guide. This one shares over 20 simple things you can do starting today to improve your health and vitality. Just head over to the Tools and Guides tab on our website, or use the QR code that's on the screen to go directly to the guide, and make sure to share all of this with your friends and family so we can all become healthier together. And with that, let's bring up our nurses. Christina Morrows and Emily Bender have been on tonight. And, you know, I'm sure they have been busy. So, Christina, Emily, can you answer the questions? Were you able to answer the questions that came your way? Or were you, did you all send them all over to Pierre?
No way. I know how to answer those questions too. We don't need Pierre all the time. Or Paul.
All right. Or any of the guests that we bring on.
No, we need our guests. The guests have valuable new information.
Emily, great to have you back.
It's good to be back.
Well, wonderful. So thank you for doing what you do, for taking your time and your expertise to help people become healthier. And I know, Christina, you were key with that guide.
Oh my gosh, Betsy, I'm so ready to talk about how we can be healthy. And we have all that great, positive, health-promoting information in our community's forum. We post fun stuff all day long. And everyone can learn all about that.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And I have to thank the folks at home now. We'll see you all, hopefully, next week. Folks, you need to be thanked as well. You know, you, our FLCCC family, near and far. You know, we're so very grateful to each and every one of you because we couldn't do anything without you. You are key to everything we do. Thank you for helping us. You know, we hope to see you next week. Same time, same place. We will be here. But first, don't leave until you have watched the My Story all the way from South Africa. Listen to what this man did and how they survived and what they are seeing now among friends, family members. What a story. And we thank him for sharing it, and we thank you for making it possible for us to help people like this. We'll see you next week. Bye.
Hi there. When the COVID thing engulfed us, I researched everything thrown at me by the media, government, etc. I live in South Africa where every authority was demanding we get vaxxed. I almost took the jab as I was 63 in the vulnerable category, and I thought, how could the entire medical system in South Africa and the government all be wrong and in lockstep? But things weren't adding up, especially the shortcutting of the vaccine test period. With the help of your web pages, research, and the FLCCC RMAS guidelines, my wife and I eventually, after prayer, decided to not take the vax. Best decision ever. We went through the pandemic for quite a few months. Then my wife got COVID and I followed shortly after. It was impossible to get ivermectin in this country. It was banned. But we managed to get some. And I took vitamin D, quercetin, zinc, all that, the stuff recommended. I was pretty sick. I went to bed for a few days, but then started to recover, as did my wife. But the bad cough wouldn't clear and I felt rotten. So I reckoned I needed an antibiotic to clear my chest. I went to our local GP. Nice guy, but he was giving people the vaccine and so on. He was happy when I said I got sick 10 days previously because that meant I was no longer infectious. So then he asked me, it seems like you have definitely had COVID. Do you want to have the test or just get an antibiotic? I said, no, just the antibiotic. And he was happy to do that. Within about 5 days, I was right as rain and I've never been sick again since then. My wife also is 100%. So many people I know have got sick since having the vax. A close friend of mine died within 10 days of having. A colleague had a stroke. Another colleague got cancer. My sister has lost 2 friends. And other friends have had strokes and heart attacks, so much more than usual. My mom-in-law nearly died after having her second vax. So thank you guys so much for all you have done for humanity. You are on the right side of history. And we are so grateful for all your help and advice. Thank you.
Your stories are powerful. They change hearts and minds. Share yours today. Send us your video or email to mystory@flccc.net.